Welcome back to PS Editors Podcast. I'm Greg Bruno, an associate editor at Project Syndicate. Today's topic, will artificial intelligence erode our own? Smart people disagree on what artificial intelligence, AI, will mean for humanity. Some, like Tesla's Elon Musk, see it as the biggest threat to civilization, while Google's Eric Schmidt predicts that machine learning will revolutionize the global economy, not unlike how the American highway system transformed the US economy. But no matter what the future looks like, there is little question that AI will change how we work, relax, and relate to one another. As my guest today argued in a recent PS piece, some of these changes will be less welcome than others. Harold James is a professor of history and international affairs at Princeton University and a longtime PS contributor. And he tends to agree with Musk. One reason AI will be bad for humanity, James says, is that it will make us much dumber. Let's ask him why.
Hello.
Hi, Harold. Thanks for joining us on PS Editors Podcast today.
Hello, Greg. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you. So I'm very interested in speaking about one of your recent columns looking at artificial intelligence and whether or not it will make us dumber. You write that the next stage in human perfectibility will require us to give up independent thinking and judgment altogether. What did you mean by that?
Well, we've already given up quite a lot of this. If you think about it, when we go on an aeroplane or we go on a car, we really surrender ourselves in many, many ways to technology, and we don't understand the technology. So I think what I'm thinking about is just a further escalation of this process. You can see it, for instance, if you think of medical diagnoses, the interpretation of radiology. You know, this is something that used to be an incredible skill that trained radiologists would do, and the data is now out that it's better if it's done by machines, and so the human doctor just needs to surrender their judgment on that particular issue if they think that that there's a particular problem and the computer diagnosis tells them there isn't. They accept what the computer says.
So it's more complicated than, say, Googling an answer that you don't know or remembering your friend's phone number versus entering it into your phone.
Well, of course, there's all of that. People don't know any numbers anymore, don't know how to do any arithmetic. You don't need to do any arithmetic. So all those kind of little practical skills that were very, very commonplace and that were important to surviving decades ago just don't matter anymore.
I think I'd rather submit myself to somebody else's expertise than rely on my own thinking when it comes to flying a plane, however.
Right. But you see what I mean, that there's a loss of control implied in this. You're just dependent on something that you don't know, you don't understand. Maybe it's better to illustrate that by thinking about automobiles. Decades ago, when I was growing up, automobiles were still really quite unreliable, and you had to know how to fix them, and there was a kind of science of how to repair an automobile, and you needed to understand how the cylinders worked and how the oil worked and so on. Now it's done completely remotely. You can't really even fix it in a garage. It just needs an electronic adjustment that's done in a completely different way. So we don't need to understand the process. And that's in some way, obviously, it's more convenient. The cars are much more reliable. But on the other hand, there's this loss of control. And I think the feeling of the loss of control just bleeds over into many other aspects of social and political life and makes people feel really, really lost at sea.
Interesting. So the next populist, quote unquote, politician might not be raising concerns over income inequality or job losses, but it might be the assault of AI and the uncontrollability of that future.
Well, exactly. I mean, whatever you want to say about Donald Trump, he's obviously not a robot. So, yes, that's exactly the kind of fascination I think that will be driving future politics.
Well, it's interesting. The argument that you make in your piece is comparing it to what happened after the first Industrial Revolution and the as the desire, the need, I should put it, for physical labor decreased with automation. People were physically weaker. And you make the analogy that with the fourth Industrial Revolution, people will become somewhat less intelligent as they let go of that control. But another impact of early industrialization was on demographics. I mean, as productivity increased, populations grew, and higher incomes led to improved nutrition, broader access to healthcare, and higher longevity. Will AI, do you think, have a similar demographic impact?
Yes. I mean, in fact, that story of increasing longevity, it's a very 20th century story, but it's still going on. And obviously, one of the things that the improved diagnosis and improved ability as a consequence to treat many chronic diseases that are quite difficult and quite unpleasant will indeed, I think, be to push up the age even further. And, you know, that creates even more problems. What are we going to do for so long when we don't really do the traditional kind of jobs anymore? That was the worry that really drove that particular piece. And, you know, you're right to say, actually, that the first Industrial Revolution, or the original Industrial Revolution, was not unambiguously bad for people, because this very, very heavy physical labor was something that wore people out. And, you know, when in the late 19th century, European societies were introducing the first pension systems, there really wasn't an expectation that manual workers would live very long, because they were simply broken by the amount of physical activity. And so, you know, in that sense, you're absolutely right. They get worn out more quickly, but they're strong. And this was the change that I was thinking about.
Mm-hmm. You know, and the other thing, as I was reading your piece and contemplating on where we're talking about in terms of these changes that you foresee with AI, it really seemed to be a concern for largely developed economies. And I wonder about the developing world. You know, one of the challenges that poor and developing countries have is creating enough jobs for a massive boom in young populations. This is often seen as a demographic dividend. Will AI cost these countries that dividend, do you think?
Yes, you're already seeing, I think, something of this, because the big debate about the onshoring of jobs, so jobs that were lost over the last decades to poorer emerging markets with cheaper labor forces, are being brought back, but with the technology that means that there's very, very little human labor involved. And exactly the same kind of process is now also being applied in many of the more dynamic emerging markets. So this is a story in China, that there's a more and more automation there. So exactly the same kind of problems will hit the emerging world. Mm-hmm. And as you say, that's really more of a problem for them, in that they have this immense potential workforce, whereas older industrial countries are in this story of, you know, many of them are below the net replacement rate, so the fertility levels have fallen dramatically. They're aging, and in some ways this replacement of man by machine fits in with their kind of demands. But for poorer countries that are still in the middle of a demographic explosion, this is really a very, very serious challenge.
And so how do countries that are in the middle of that demographic explosion, how do they respond? Is it through increased innovation at home, or is it through something completely different, like exodus?
Well, exodus is clearly one of the ways out, and that's a phenomenon that we see in large parts of the world. But it really has its problems as well, in that if the more mobile or more dynamic a part of a population moves out and leaves older people and poorer people and sicker people behind, there's often a challenge there how to care for the population that remains. And if you look in East Central Europe, Southern Europe, that's exactly one of the major scares, that they're losing the dynamic element of their societies through emigration, and they're left unable to provide basic resources. So emigration and demographic decline are major factors in also in the political debates in Eastern and Central Europe.
Much of the conversation that we're having and that others have related to AI is that this is an inevitability, that we're in the middle of these changes, and whether the changes come to labor force participation or intelligence, as we're discussing, the reality is it's going to happen. One of the things that you said in your piece that I thought kind of for me raised a question, at least to the inevitability. You say that, human companionship might in some way be replaced by AI technology, in caring for older people and caring for aging demographics. But how inevitable is this future? I mean, even people with smartphones need human companionship and a hug every now and then. If AI can't give us that, wouldn't humans just shy away from a future that denies us our basic needs?
Well, you're right. I think you're obviously right. I don't think anybody would doubt that the entirely artificial intelligence driven robot can't really replace the human being, because to start with, the AI robot is entirely predictable. I'm sure many people have had conversations with their mobile phone, with these digital assistants, with Siri on the Apple products. There are many others in the meantime, and it's quite fun to do that. It's quite a good way to learn another language, have a conversation with Siri in a foreign language. But it's in the end very, very unsatisfying, and you get bored with it very quickly. Whereas humans are full of unpredictability, and that's the delight and the surprise of dealing with real people. But I think one of the issues will be that that will become a kind of luxury product. So you already see it, that there's a kind of bifurcation, say in restaurants that are almost entirely automated, where you press the selections and it comes more or less automatically. And then there are upmarket restaurants where people pay a fortune, where they're just swirled around by waiters and the cooks come and talk to them and explain what the dishes are. But that's a niche product, and it's exactly the same story. I think that's where I find the parallel with the First Industrial Revolution really helpful, in that that's exactly what happened in the First Industrial Revolution, that it produced cheaper and more available products for a large number of people. And then there were kind of elite niche products for the top end of the market. But that was a kind of separate phenomenon. And what I worry about with the development of artificial intelligence is exactly that large numbers of people will really be disconnected more and more from ordinary human contact, and that's impoverishing. It's mentally, psychologically, spiritually impoverishing to be in that situation.
And yet the future that you're charting here will be irreversible. We won't recognize it as it's happening collectively, as a species, and we'll be giving up our ability to go back to square one.
In many ways, we're right in the middle of it. A lot of this has already happened. It's I think one of those processes that people look at. They're perplexed. They're in the middle of it. But no, there's no obvious way of reversing it, because it produces, on the face of it, so many gains. But you also lose an enormous amount. So I mean, I think that experience is not a new phenomenon. If you think back, when Christopher Marlowe wrote his play about the experience apparently of a real magician in early 16th century Germany, Dr. Faustus. What Faustus gets is a whole series of little tricks. They're fun things to do. They're a bit like the digital gadgets that we can have. You can be invisible and hit the Pope on the head, and it's very funny, and it's good for a laugh, but it's deeply, deeply impoverishing, and it robs Faust, and that's clearly the upshot. It robs Faust of his humanity.
I want to go back to the picture you painted of sitting in a restaurant and having to ask or pay a premium to talk to the person who produced my food to even ask what I'm eating. That suggests that we're talking about a society of very different types of inequality that's potentially being generated. If you can pay to speak to somebody that's producing something for you, well, then you're in a different class of people than if you can only afford to push buttons and have your food come out on a conveyor belt. Is the future that you're painting essentially a new type of inequality that might not be fully defined as of yet, but it is moving in very dangerous directions?
Yes, it's a new type of inequality in the sense that it's not measurable in the conventional terms, but obviously the conventional measurements of inequality, levels of income or levels of wealth, will also dictate how you're able to interact with people. So the people with higher incomes, high levels of wealth, will buy these personal interactions. But then if you think about it, you follow on this kind of Dr. Faustus path. If you buy personal interactions, that's not very satisfactory either. That's not really how human friendship operates. And so nobody is really going to win out of this. You may feel if you're buying the services that you're having for the moment a better experience, but it's not really, in the end, what we think of as a fully human experience.
Right. This conversation seems to be very much black and white in so many ways. And I wonder if there's a place to bring AI technology in that is slightly less that it doesn't necessarily paint such a dystopian future. And I think what we're seeing in some of the ways that AI is being incorporated into the industrial base already is humans working alongside robots. And this term cobots is a term that's being used in the manufacturing of airplanes and the manufacturing of vehicles. And humans literally being wrapped and working alongside robot companions. But do you see AI as all or nothing?
Well, I don't think what I was presenting was altogether dystopian because I'm absolutely convinced that there are many, many advantages of this process. For instance, you go back to something like the medical diagnosis, you can give much, much more accurate diagnoses. And so you can detect diseases more quickly, treat them more effectively. All of this is just very, very impressive, and it's going to lead to longer life. I think your attempt to give a kind of twist of it where humans are really still steering the process, it's brave, but it doesn't really confront quite the reality of what this engagement of humans with machine technology involves. I'm struck by it actually, in the sense of just personal examples. The people who drive Uber taxis in the United States. At the beginning, this was a great experience and it was fun. And I had many, many conversations with Uber drivers about what they were doing and how it had changed their lives. And over the last year or so, I've noticed that it's almost impossible to have these conversations because the drivers are so fixated on interacting with their technology. They seem as if they're really slaves of the particular machine, and they don't want to have a conversation. They think that that's a distraction, they just see themselves more as fitted into the technology than fitted into the human interaction.
Sure, but the Uber driver's working. What about leisure? In an AI-dominated world, Do you think that people will find pursuits or hobbies that are uniquely human?
Well, human relations, romantic relations, love, I mean, that's obviously an area that the computer can't venture into. But even there, it starts to dictate people's lives. If you think of these enormously popular dating applications, they're doing exactly that. They're replacing something that was deeply human by something that is based on an algorithm that in many ways may be quite perceptive. It may put you in contact with the right kind of person, but the whole business of human society up to now has been the unpredictable and how people react to the unpredictable. And that's what's going to be lost.
That was really fascinating. Harold, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you, Greg.
That was Harold James, professor of history and international affairs at Princeton University. You can read all of his PS columns at www.project-syndicate.org. And that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening. Be sure to rate and review our podcast and subscribe on SoundCloud, Stitcher, and iTunes. Until next time, don't do anything stupid. I'm Greg Bruno.